From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll dive into the Milwaukee County budget and explore why there's a multi-million dollar deficit. Then we'll learn about sickle cell disease and how it largely impacts people living in southeastern Wisconsin.
It basically impacts not only development, but also socioeconomic life, their adulthood, and also quality of life.
Plus, we'll tell you about a mobile piece of artwork on the move in Milwaukee that focuses on curbing reckless driving.
This project will be ridiculous and delightful and amusing and hopefully insightful, and the conversations I hope will be more inclusive.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. It's budget season in Milwaukee, both for the city and the county. At a local town hall this week, Milwaukee County's budget office presented a $19 million deficit for 2025. That got residents worried about what this means for essential services they rely on. They also wanted to know more about the sheriff's $7 million deficit in overtime, how much did the RNC cost taxpayers, and why the county isn't tapping into the state's $3 billion plus surplus. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez sat down with 17th District County Supervisor Steve Taylor, who's brought forth a lot of these same issues before. But first, he's joined by County Budget Director Joe Lamers to break down the budget's current state and the process to finalize the budget.
Well, we're talking about the county, not city budget. Can we start by table setting a bit here? Where does this money come from and how does it get spent?
We have a wide mix of funding. We have the property tax, sales tax are the local tax collections. We also have departments collecting revenues directly to support their programs, like the airport fully funds themselves with airline revenues, Medicaid revenues for human services. And then we also receive state and federal funds to offset the cost of programs that are mandated by state and federal government, a wide variety. And then it's spent, the largest share of our budget does get spent on those mandated programs that are required by the state. And then we do have some programs that are, you know, local priorities like the parks and our transit system that receive local tax levy funds.
Okay. And how is the budget set for different services?
You know, we have to look at the limitations of the revenues that we collect. And then each department has, you know, their metrics for determining the level of staffing needs and other operational needs that they have. And then they request, you know, funding within the budget process. Because we are operating with a structural deficit, we do have a process that includes levy targets, so we limit the amount of funding that the departments, you know, put forward within their requests, because we really don't have enough funding to provide for everything that they're looking for. Just background on that is we have our property tax collections are limited by 1.3% per year. So that's how much our largest form of tax revenue grows by. And then also a lot of the aid revenues that we receive from the state have been historically flat and sometimes reduced. Although we did in last year's budget have some benefits of Act 12, including an increase in shared revenue, not enough to cover all of the needs we have at the county.
A lot to keep an eye on then going forward with that. This is not a setup, this next question, I promise, but who is in charge of finding the fixes and what's on the table?
So for we have the current budget, which is the $19 million deficit is what we're faced with currently for this budget year. So we are from the budget office preparing a request to our county board for the September cycle, which would eliminate, you know, a deficit of $19 million. And we're going to be submitting a report and proposal within the next week to the board, and they will review it in September. But what it includes is we've looked at all of our capital projects that are financed without bonding, and we've found a multi-million dollar savings there just on estimated savings. And we've also taken a close look at our ARPA state and local fiscal recovery fund allocations. Just to give an example, we have some programs that were operating until 2026 potentially. And we're saying, you know, maybe they will have to end in 25 and instead. We have some programs that may end with some surplus. And we do have also a component within our reduction plan. We would pull funding from our debt service reserve. So although we have a $19 million deficit this year, we actually had surpluses that were larger than that in previous years. So we've built up a rainy day fund at the county that's over $100 million. Those funds are intended for this type of purpose, unexpected revenue loss. I'm expecting that amount to be less than $5 million. So we've identified about $14 million of savings options, and then we're taking $5 million out of our debt service reserve. Although the report's not fully finalized, that's what we're kind of looking at.
I think I just heard a collective sigh from people thinking about what essential services they may be losing sooner than later. But as you kind of laid out the dipping into reserves and the earlier exit of these one-time programs dealing with the budget, you did talk about the structural deficits within the budget as well. What does this mean for future budgets? Do you have a sense of what cuts could be considered and what does get prioritized?
We just have to continue to try to be creative with programs and look for efficiencies and savings. And we have to keep working on partnerships with organizations that help fund us, like the state and the federal government, and, you know, other opportunities like public-private partnerships.
You know, a question I had too, when we're talking about the budget, is this is an annual process. Where are we currently in that process?
So right now we have the requested budgets on hand from the departments. They submit them on July 15th, and then the county executive works with the budget office and departments to develop the recommended budget that gets completed and made public on October 1st. And then the county board deliberates on the budget in October and November, and they vote on the budget in November.
When can the public get involved and kind of be heard for the services that they find essential or maybe the non-mandated services that they rely on? How can they make their voices heard to supervisors, the board, and the budget's office?
So, you know, we continue to have town hall meetings from the county executive. There's two more that are scheduled. And then during the budget process as well, the county board members will have a number of their own town halls of their own. And there will also be a series of meetings with the finance committee where all of the departments come and present their budgets. And there's always an opportunity for public comment. And then the residents could also reach out directly to their supervisors or the county exec or even the budget office as well. We have our contact information posted on our website. So there are various ways, and there's scheduled meetings, and then there's opportunities to just reach out directly as well.
All right, so let's start off. If you could just introduce yourself and tell me why we're talking to you.
Steve Taylor. I'm a Milwaukee County Supervisor representing Franklin and Oak Creek. I'm here to talk about the county budget.
We are looking at quite a deficit this year. I think the latest numbers I saw were around $19 million. In your opinion, how do we get here?
Well, there's really, I think, three things. One, obviously, a large overtime budget issue with the Sheriff's Department, and some of that's in the House of Corrections. So those two things combined is like $11 million, I believe. If you take a look at like $7.5 million for the Sheriff's overtime budget, and then $4 million deficit at the House of Corrections. A couple million dollars of that is the food vendor, just the cost of that new contract. Then we have the situation where you have not as much sales tax revenue as projected. So we projected a certain dollar amount coming in, and people just are not spending like we thought they would in Milwaukee County. So the sales tax numbers are down. And then I think what the county staff has told us, the administration has told us, is that healthcare costs are a little higher than expected. So I think it's those three which are getting us to, you know, this $19 million projected deficit by the end of the year.
I know there was conversation of Act 12, which you're talking about the sales tax.
Yeah.
And just as a reminder, this is kind of the legislation that went forward that the county exec and others committed to that would maintain, amongst other things, maintain and increase police numbers and return police to some MPS schools and change the outlook of the Fire and Police Commission. What is it not doing? Why is it not performing in the way that folks thought it would?
Well, I mean, if we focus on the county, I mean, when the cities was a 2% increase and the counties was a 0.4, and I voted no on the sales tax for a number of reasons, but it's not generating enough of what we projected. So when you build a budget based on projections and the numbers don't fall in line, then you have, you know, a deficit. Now, when it comes like the sheriff's department, they come to the department, to the administration, ask for X amount of dollars, don't get what they need. And we all know they're going to run a deficit. They just do not have the manpower to properly staff, you know, the highways, our courts, our lakefront. And so, you know, they have some things that they do that are mandated, you know, the jail, you know, the House of Correction, the highways, the courts, they're just going to run an overtime.
I want to ask your perspective as someone who's been familiar with the budget over a length of time, because we're not dealing with your traditional budget over the past couple of years. You know, you're looking at this infusion of ARPA funds, like a ton of federal money, the Act 12 and the sales tax more recently to the county budget, just lots of changes.
You must have been watching some of our county board meetings, because I have been warning our colleagues for the last 2 years that this upcoming budget, this 2025 budget, was going to be brutal. And for those that weren't in office prior to 2020, they have no idea. And it's not going to be easy. You're going to be looking at cuts in departments. You're going to be looking at projects that you want to add to the, you know, to the capital project list. Not going to happen. We thought that the sales tax was going to, you know, bring us this much revenue, and now it's not. And man, we thought if we would raise the salaries on those working in the jail and we hire more deputies, that the overtime numbers will go down. None of those things have worked out the way it was intended.
Right. As a final question, what should residents expect from this budget and the budget going forward from the services that they depend and rely on or come to really equate with Milwaukee County?
You know what, there's a saying, you know, there's a difference between wants and needs. And I think decisions are gonna be made that focuses on the needs, not the wants. I think we're gonna have to deal with the crucial services that the residents expect. I mean, there may not be as much money put into our park system compared to previous years. I mean, we've pumped a lot of money into the parks because, you know, when you have $1.3 billion of deferred maintenance, half a billion of that in the park system, you want to try to catch up or try to, you know, make a dent in it, because parks are something that all of our residents enjoy. But parks are not a mandated service. What are we going to do about busing? I mean, we're going to have real problems next year if we don't come up with a dedicated funding source. There's going to be route cuts, route eliminations, and then that causes people to have problems getting to and from work. So I think we're going to have to really look at what is, you know, mandated by Milwaukee County, and where do we have our own discretion if we have extra money. And the last 4 years, we've had extra money because of, you know, the pandemic. I think it's, like I said, it's a difference between wants and needs. And our residents should understand that you may want a nicer playground, or you may want a, you know, senior center upgrade because it's a little, you know, run down. But there are other, you know, needs that are mandated by the state that we have to perform.
That was 17th District County Supervisor Steve Taylor and the county's budget director, Joe Lamers. They both joined Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. According to the CDC, about 1 in 13 African Americans are born with a genetic trait that can cause sickle cell disease. In Wisconsin, about 85% of those patients live in the southeastern region. Research into sickle cell disease is underway across the country, including here in Milwaukee. Dr. Preethu Sund is a senior investigator at the Versity Blood Research Institute, working to find the root cause of the disease and how to prevent complications from the disorder that can often prove fatal for patients. He joins me now to share more about his lab's work and begins by explaining the basics of sickle cell disease.
Sickle cell disease is a genetic blood disease and is basically caused by a genetic mutation in your hemoglobin, which is the protein responsible for carrying oxygen in your blood, and is mostly packed in your red blood cells. So what happened thousands of years ago in areas, especially in the sub-Saharan Africa or the West African areas, people were exposed to malaria thousands of years ago when it used to be a wetland. And that's how this mutation developed, because it used to give protection from malaria. But then we all get one copy of a gene from our father and one from a mother. When two people with mutation, they had kids, the kids, unfortunately, those kids who got the defective copy from both the parents, this disease became symptomatic. So if you have only one copy, then you are a carrier, you're not symptomatic. But when you get two copies, you become symptomatic. And that's how the disease came. And it basically changes the shape of your red blood cells. So instead of being very soft, squishy, they become needle-shaped, stiff, and they stop in your blood vessels, and due to which your blood flow stops and you feel pain. And then it also causes organ damage. You know, it can cause respiratory failure. It can cause stroke, many other cardiovascular complications, you know. So that's the history and pathophysiology of the disease.
So we're talking about blood cells being impacted in the way they physically function and look. And obviously, blood is needed for all bodily functions. So I cannot imagine how complicated it must be to deal with sickle cell. And this is something that gets worse over time, correct? If someone has it, it is ultimately a leading cause of death.
After 3 months of age, the disease starts showing symptoms. And because of these blood events, your organs are damaged again and again and again and again. So as you grow older, your organs are being impacted so much that they start losing function. And by the time you're adult, a lot of your organs don't function as properly as it would function in a normal human being. Like your kidney may not filter or urine properly. Your liver may not function properly. Your lungs can have scarring because of the multiple events. You have pain all over the body all the time. You can develop blood ulcers. Then the people develop retinopathy. Their eyesight becomes, some people develop necrosis of the hip bone. Joints become bad. Bone marrow is all affected. Every organ in the body, you know, is affected. Children develop cognitive dysfunction because of silent infarcts in their brain, silent strokes, small events. So it basically impacts not only development, but also socioeconomic life, their adulthood, and also quality of life in general, I would say. Their quality of life is not as good as a human, normal human being, because of all these pains and sufferings, multiple visits to the emergency department, taking medicines. It just hits hard on their overall lifestyle. You know, it's just a debilitating disease. Median life used to be 45, but now I think it's 50s or 60s.
So with such an impact on overall quality of life and health, what populations does sickle cell affect the most?
So in US, it's mostly affecting the African American But sickle cell disease mutations have happened all over the globe along the belt where malaria was very prevalent. So there's sub-Saharan Africa, then Middle East, some parts of Asia, and also because of the populations that didn't mix up with the whole world, they were more inbreeding, it survived there more. So now there are more than 8 million patients in the world. But in US, it mostly affects African Americans.
So what does this look like here in Wisconsin?
So in Wisconsin, it has a lot of veterans. So Milwaukee has 40% African Americans. And you can say one out of every 300 African American will have the symptomatic disease. And then one out of 10 are the carriers. So their kids can have the disease. So there are a lot of patients, at least 500 adult patients, and equal or maybe more than the pediatric patients in just Milwaukee. And then Milwaukee has also a lot of veterans. And although U.S. Army doesn't recruit sickle cell disease patients, but they do recruit sickle cell carriers. So there are many veterans whose family members have these diseases. And in Wisconsin, I think the Florida Hospital is the only clinic which serves them. So it's relatively, if you compare sickle cell population all over the U.S., so Milwaukee has a very decent size compared to many places.
So with such a high population of people impacted by sickle cell, especially here in southeastern Wisconsin, what are some of the social barriers that are an obstacle to better care and treatments?
Yeah, Milwaukee is, unfortunately, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities, and most of the population, patients who belong to a population that is not economically as strong, they don't have the best access. Sickle cell disease crisis can be triggered by many things, your socioeconomic lifestyle, changes in temperatures, how you live, if you're having exposed to infection. So all these symptoms play into role, And second, they belong to a community which has been underserved. So they have hesitation to approach healthcare. And many of them don't trust the healthcare system because of their experiences in the past. So that is also an issue. And then many times these patients are prescribed opioids for pain. But I've also heard and read literature that many times when these patients approach a pharmacy for opioids, they are denied. So that's also an issue. And then other social barriers are that they don't participate. They don't like to visit a hospital unless it's uncontrollable and they have to go, because they have anecdotes of mistrust passed on to them through several generations that they can be misused or their information can be misused. And so the history actually is there, but I think organizations, including organizations like Versity, they're helping to get rid of that mistrust over time. And maybe next generation will be more willing to participate and approach healthcare system as needed.
So your job is researching these health complications that come with sickle cell disease. So can you share a bit about what your lab is working on and some of the big goals you're trying to reach in order to try and have treatments be more accessible or just to help understand this disease a little more?
So right now, there is no therapy that a patient goes to the emergency department and just takes the therapy and comes back, or something they can take at home to avoid going to the being admitted to an ICU or an emergency department. So we are basically trying to understand that how we can develop more like a rescue therapies, that somebody gets into pain, unbearable pain. Is there something that they can take at home so that it can resolve on its own, or they go to the emergency department and they quickly give that and then send them back home rather than keeping them in the hospital? Because the healthcare, then you can cut down the healthcare cost. That's also an issue. Right now, it's around $4 billion per, and that's 80% of that cost is because of these people have to visit the emergency department for pain. So we can cut down that. So that is also we are considering. So that one of the main focus in the lab is to generate rescue therapies that can resolve a pain crisis or can resolve hospitals stay and they can go ham quickly, or they don't even have to come with us. So we are working with some companies to generate subcutaneous therapies like an insulin injection, so that if a patient is feeling pain or nausea or has a signs of symptoms that they can go in crisis, they can take that subcutaneous injection. Because some of the therapies right now, you have to go to the hospital to get an infusion, IV infusion. We cannot do it at home. So that's the goal right now. We are trying to understand from the basic level that what is causing that and how we can resolve it if it starts to happen.
What are some of the challenges that you face in researching sickle cell and therapies for it? Do you come across problems of like needing more diversity in blood samples, or, you know, recruiting people to be part of studies?
Yeah, recruitment is one of the issues, because like I said, you know, sickle cell populations are always not very big. And now if they have a fear of approaching, if they don't want to come to the blood center and donate blood, then that affects our ability to find new therapies. So that is something they should understand, that blood donation will help create new therapies for sickle cell patients. And also the blood donation from non-sickle healthy humans of African American community is also important, because that's the blood which is most appropriate to be used for transfusion therapy for these patients. And the problem is that most of the blood is right now being donated by Caucasians. So when you transfuse sickle patients with Caucasian blood, it causes complications and sometimes even causes more hospitalization. For sustaining one sickle patient, you need like 10 blood donations from 10 healthy African Americans every year. But that equation is mismatched. So it not only affects our ability to do research to find new therapies, but it also impacts patients, because they have less available resources for blood transfusion.
So there's this need for more diversity in blood donations, but what is Versity trying to do with outreach in the community to promote and to encourage people to come and give blood and also have a good experience and feel comfortable?
Yeah, Versity is actually doing a lot of efforts on that, both on the community level and also on the commercial scale. So they have now active participation in reaching out to these communities through educational programs, but they're also starting their own blood center in the Versity on King. And that is primarily being made to first attract folks from the African-American community, to train them as phlebotomists, enroll them, hire them, and then through them, they can reach out to the folks in the community and tell them that why it is important to come and donate blood. So they're trying to engage with the community so that the blood donation by African Americans can increase. And this also opens a window to communicate with this population and, you know, educate them that some of their fears may not be relevant in this era. And then also explaining them what are the positive sides, that how a blood donation by African Americans is so necessary for treatment of sickle cell patients who belong to their community. And also, you know, young kids in this community needs to participate in research. You know, we have always opportunities open for them to come and work at the Blood Institute, high school students, undergraduates, so that they can be part of the research. They have the opportunity to come and work here and not only learn about the disease, but also contribute to the new findings.
Well, today I want to thank you for helping to go through what sickle cell disease is and some of the work you're doing to try and change the course of the challenges it presents. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Preethu Sund is a senior investigator at the Versity Blood Research Institute and professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. In about 10 minutes, your job will be beach science to be exact. But first, we'll hear from Milwaukee's artist in residence about her piece, The Moving City, which aims to raise awareness about and curb reckless driving. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee's first public artist in residence unveiled her mobile work of art this week called The Moving City. The artist, Sarah David, designed a truck that was rescued from a municipal tow lot that features carvings of Milwaukee landmarks, traffic cones, and messages about traffic safety. The Moving City will be displayed in six different locations over the next 2 weeks. Lake Effect Sam Woods spoke with David while she was designing the piece. She begins by describing the project.
So the general art car came across a lot of my experience with the Burning Man community. Art cars are actually how you get around out there, as aside from foot and bicycle traffic. And so having a lot of those ideas in the back of my head about mobile solutions for mobile problems. So if something is happening all over the city, how can you address that with a single mural in one place? How can you address that with a sculpture in one place? So how do you make a piece of art mobile? How can you set up that path to success for a solution that has the most impact over the greatest collection of populations? So I started with the idea of just covering this car in traffic cones and have later moved into carving the buildings of Milwaukee and the landmarks of Milwaukee onto these cones. So we have North Point Tower, we have the Basilica, we have a cone dedicated to River West 24. We have the Bronze Fonz is on there, as well as the P&H shovel out near the Miller Park. And then also we're carving the abandoned gas station on Wisconsin and 25th. There's things that people use to navigate the world, and they don't necessarily correlate directly to the skyline of Milwaukee. Yeah. And so the top of the car is going to be sort of all of these buildings rising out of sort of the lake. So we have the Hone Bridge on the front, and we have the beaches on the side. So it is a moving city by a lake. And while the proposal was about reckless driving, I prefer to talk about driving safety and driving skill rather than the alienation of the term reckless, that it is very othering. It is very it also allows you an excuse to sort of back out of that conversation because it's not about you.
Yeah. Like, I'm not a reckless driver. That's everyone else. Right.
Totally safe as I'm texting down the road and eating a sandwich at the same time. What does that look like? So anyway, how do you bring some of that conversation to all the people in kind of the middle, who almost all the people who have to deal with driving challenges on the road, is that there are people who are genuinely reckless, and there's people who would never answer the question, "I am reckless."
Yeah, it sounds like the art car is meant to be the vehicle for conversation around, like, all right, how can we be better, and how can we each take a small step to being a better driver that hopefully adds up to safer roadways?
Right. And so it's, you know, how can you be a better driver? How can you be a better pedestrian? How can you behave in a way that is more predictable? Because it is the covenant of predictability that allows the road systems to operate the way that they do, with the reliability and functions that they do. If there isn't that predictability, if you are not operating within the general cultural norms of the space that you are moving through, will you cause people to have even tension, or just, you know, if you're deciding that you're in charge of the scenario, what does that mean? And how does that go? So,
yeah. Well, tell me about how your interest in this topic has evolved over time, because I'm guessing it wasn't you sent an application in to be artist in residence and then just started thinking about, you know, reckless driving, traffic safety. Right. So how has this evolved for you over time?
So some of the evolution comes from my involvement with the bicycle community out of Boston, specifically the Skull Bicycle Chopper Gang, the Subversive Choppers Urban Legion. They were chopping out bicycles and riding around in a phenomenal sort of moving community. They had radio stations that broadcast to other ships in the fleet because they're huge nerds, and that's delightful.
That's a fun thing to know about, yeah. You know, biker gangs is they truly in their heart of hearts, huge nerds.
Exactly. So we were building choppers. We were riding them every Saturday. They've been doing it for at least 30 years now, which is phenomenal. And also I was bicycle commuting every 6 years out there in the winter. Everything, all of that was being done. So I have a lot of bicycle perspectives, but then also my dad was a race car driver and also got heavily into motorcycles. So I remember being a young person, and he gave me a movie called On Any Sunday. And there was basically an entire blooper reel of that communicated why it was important to wear leathers, because you showed so many motorcyclists crashing,
yeah.
And then skidding in a way that they were able to walk away from. Mm. And then also, you know, one of his big driving lessons for me was to take me out on a sheet of ice in the back parking lot and say, turn the wheel all the way to the left and now step on the gas. And when you feel like you're going to vomit, get out of it.
Jeez. Okay.
But that's a skill. Yeah. You have to learn to countersteer.
Yeah.
And you have to learn to kind of let... not freak out and slam on the brakes, or not freak out and slam on the gas. And that skill has stayed with me. You know, sometimes there's different ways you are driving a giant machine, and that is a skill.
Mm-hmm.
That is a skill that requires awareness, it requires engagement, it requires attention, it requires sometimes a lighter touch than you might normally if you kind of hold on too tight. You think you're controlling it, but you're actually the most out of control you could be.
How have these travels and conversations that you've had with people having to do with driving and transportation, and then, of course, your own driving lessons,
mm-hmm.
How have they helped you in this process of bringing people along with the ARCAR project?
So a good chunk of the most recent 10 years of my life has been operating in social change spaces and international development spaces. And so how do you... understand that sometimes the relationships and the process is more important than the outcome of the product,
mm-hmm.
of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you build those relationships so that those messages land in a softer, more receptive place?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get people to believe in your work who aren't your mother? You know, how do you get people to be open and receptive to the conversation? And sometimes that is by bringing in something that is completely ridiculous. This project will be ridiculous and delightful and amusing and hopefully insightful. And the conversations, I hope, will be more inclusive than I might normally expect.
Talk more about that approach and, as you say, kind of, you know, it's supposed to be ridiculous. You know, mm-hmm. The Milwaukee Magazine piece quotes you as saying that that this approach of using art to address, reckless driving and traffic safety stands in contrast to punitive measures like fines and speed bumps. Why is this balance and this, you know, as you say, like ridiculous approach mm-hmm. important?
So when you talk about people who have sort of lived with a tremendous amount of trauma from loss, from fear, from just general tension from walking through the day, I spoke to one person who said, I'm feeling this road, and I'm feeling just the tension and anger that's coming from this road.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of said, mm-hmm. hold up, we have to sort of unpack that a little bit and think about what would that do to your ability to navigate this road effectively. If you approach your environment, your neighborhoods, your space with fear, what does that mean? How do you get people who are feeling as if, because their neighborhoods are dangerous, how do they get from A to B as fast as they can? How do they get from there in a way that allows them to feel in control of this one thing that they normally might not feel in control of anything else in their life? That if they can't control their income, their money, their housing, their situation, all that thing, in this moment behind this wheel, I'm in control of this one thing. So how can you bring some of that message and alleviate that fear with a sense of skill and an attentiveness to how that all can make us all better drivers, or even just conflict management? Because if you see someone behaving poorly on the roads, you will find people who will like try and like cut you off extra just to prove you were wrong or teach you a lesson or do something like that, when really the proper response is just let it go. if you feel unsafe, exit the road until you feel safe again.
Yeah.
You know, how can you teach that? That's a skill.
Yeah.
To recognize that this situation is unsafe and I am completely and totally within the agency to leave that situation.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Sarah David is the City of Milwaukee's first public artist in residence. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. When you head to the beach, you're probably not thinking about all the science you can see around you. Learn about how to soak up the sun and the science of the beach next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before we close out today's show, we're going to the beach, where the sun is shining, kids are screaming, and there's lots to learn. Our guide is Hannah Wege, a professor of chemistry at Wisconsin Lutheran College. She joins WUWM's Lena Tran to talk about all the science you can find when you're playing in the sand.
I meet Hannah Wege at South Beach Park in Port Washington. We don't even make it past the parking lot before she notices a butterfly. Its upper wings are streaked with orange and black, like a tiger, and the underside of its wings are all warm browns and grays, with spots that look like eyes. The butterfly floats up to greet her and lands on her finger, just one of the many wonders that Hannah hunts for when she's at the beach. Wonders that she says you can train yourself to notice, and wonders that enrich your experience of the world around you.
When I do nature walk, I'm always observing and trying to look for interesting things. So when I'm at the beach, I'm often looking for fossils. Fossils are everywhere. People should know this. You can just sit down and dig, and you can find fossils everywhere on the beach.
So this is what Hannah does at the beach. She zooms in, observes, uses all her senses. She says she's the kind of person who prefers the rigor of the school year to endless summer days. So when she's at the beach, she likes the structure of paying attention.
Yeah, it does give me a sense of mission, gives me a purpose. And again, as a scientist, I mean, I'm always like trying to ask questions and trying to observe. I think one of the things I realized as I like walk down a beach or something like that, it's different every time I go. It's different every time I go. And I'm different every time I go. But you only notice that if you're noticing it, or if you're like looking closely at what's around you. So that's
what I wanted to talk to Hannah about. What kinds of things can we learn from a walk on the beach? Of course, she is a chemistry professor, so she has some knowledge about the beach and Lake Michigan that makes even the sand between our toes seem special. We're both wearing sandals.
Sand is made up of a variety of things, but largely it's comprised of silica, which is the mineral form of the molecule silicon dioxide. Mixed in with the sand, of course, there would be other like shells, which would be calcium carbonate. The way we use silica is we melt, that's why sand is a component in glass. That silicon dioxide is like window pane glass. But there are actually creatures that eat sand, which I think is kind of mind-blowing. Cyanobacteria actually will eat through silicon dioxide, so grains of sand, so these tiny microbes. It seems like they're scavenging for things like iron and manganese. But also, once the sand has been sort of eaten through and released as individual molecules, other creatures, diatoms in particular, actually use that silicon dioxide, those little molecules that make up sand, to create their exoskeleton. And they have these like really lacy patterns that form sort of a cage. And so if you were able to look really closely at the sand under a microscope, you would not only see little jagged pieces of quartz and silica, you would see these intricate patterns made of glass. It's like a glass house that it makes for itself.
And all this stuff is constantly on the move. The sand you take a nap on, the stuff that gets stuck in your shoes and hair.
Those grains of sand were eroded from bedrock, like at the bottom of the lake. So wind and waves abrade the rock and create little pieces of sand, which is what washes up on the shore. Once it gets to shore, it continues to move with the wind. We're in Port Washington, so there's big bluffs. So the little pieces of sand, the little pieces of silt and clay that travel the furthest end up on the bluffs. And so what's underneath you at the sand is always moving. It's always new. It's always being renewed. Either
heavy rain can speed things up, make things move faster. It's something we can see now as climate change brings more intense precipitation to the Great Lakes. A couple years ago, there was a landslide in Port Washington. Rain had soaked the mud and clay until it was too heavy for the bluff to hold. This was on North Beach, one of Hannah's favorite spots on Lake Michigan. She and her kids went to another park up on the bluffs to check out the landslide from above.
The reddish clay kind of tumbled down the bluffs and just completely like wiped out the path.
And looking further back, how was all of this created? You know, where did it come from?
The bedrock that's at the bottom of the Great Lakes basins, they are volcanic in origin. And of course, in order to get these little pieces of sand that we see on the beaches today, glaciers came through and carved out the basins for the Great Lakes. And then those little pieces of rock that got eroded by the glaciers is what we see as sand. And these are like movable pieces of silicon dioxide now.
Yeah, I love that. In Wisconsin, everything always comes back to the glaciers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yes. Yeah. We are only here because they carved out this place for us.
What does it look like? Hannah says she wasn't always this way. She grew up in Wisconsin, enjoying Lake Michigan, a lot like her kids do now, scrambling on bluffs and splashing in the water. But now her walks have this focus to them. She's contemplative and observant. She notices what's changed and has her eyes out for things she's maybe never seen before. She searches milkweed plants for caterpillars and hunts for agates, gems that contain bands of color painted by the lake. For her, things kind of shifted when she was in graduate school, getting her PhD in chemistry.
I was, you know, sort of in the midst of my science training and also starting a family. And so I was like really slowed down during that like period of time where I was like studying something really, really intently in graduate school, where I was like doing this really intense observation. And of course, having small children, you just can't move very quickly. And so trying to get outside with my children and spending time just resulted in me having to slow down. And I think that's really when this sort of world of science all around me sort of opened up, and also sort of being trained to observe really closely sort of like coalesced. So I was definitely a grown-up. Like by the time I sort of had this attitude of going to the beach and like really looking and observing.
Being a mom and then being a scientist, both of those things are like huge learning curves in their own way.
Absolutely.
And they just happened at the same time.
They did. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I chose to have children in graduate school, which again was kind of an odd thing to do. That's not something a lot of people choose. But it was a really very special time for me. And yeah, it really brought me new perspectives in two different ways at the same time.
So Hannah's kids are also teaching her new ways to see the water. A couple years ago, after they'd all gaped at the wreckage of the landslide, they came back down to South Beach, and Hannah's daughter made this observation.
As we were looking for fossils on the beach, she recognized, she said, no one has ever seen these rocks before. They are new every time we come. And she's absolutely right that it's just fascinating to think that a pebble that you pick up on the beach may never have been viewed by a human before. It had been unearthed like from the depths of the bedrock, you know, on the floor of the lake. And so it's just, even though it's ancient, it's new.
After Hannah and I say goodbye, she walks back across the beach to the parking lot. I notice while she's walking, her eyes are trained down on the sand. Who knows what she might see? For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
Lena spoke with Hannah Wege, a professor of chemistry at Wisconsin Lutheran College. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Eddie Morales and Emily Files from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation with Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson. He reflects on hosting the Republican National Convention and shares how he'll be involved in next week's Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.